This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. This half hour is brought to you by Larson & Larson. They are my intellectual property lawyers, and they should be yours. Well, I am really thrilled to welcome back to Joy on Paper the author of one of my favorite books, and to celebrate the release of the 30th anniversary edition of one of his most famous books, and favorite books of mine too, Rampage. Hi.
Well, hi, Patsy. How are you?
Well, I am talking to Justin Scott, and I tell you, Justin, this is really exciting that they have brought out this 30th anniversary edition.
It's too bad you couldn't be in New York last week. The publisher, Pegasus, gave a fabulous party at the Players to kick it off, and we had a ball. We even had Peter Minton on the piano. It was just like we brought back the New York of the 80s.
Oh, well, that is fantastic. And this book deserves to come back, and because it is one of those classics in the in this whole range of, you know, if you're talking about books about the mafia or books about crime, Rampage just holds up so beautifully.
Thank you. It's, you know, you have certain old friends you've written, and this was one of them for me. A lot of times you pick up a book you wrote years ago and you say, well, now that knowing what I know now, I could really, you know, really do a job on it. And this was one of those rare times I picked it up and I thought, you know, I really wouldn't change anything. So when they offered to bring it back, I was more than thrilled.
Well, that's exactly how I felt when I was reading it. You know, I read it 30 years ago, and because I have been such a fan ever since I read Normandy Triangle. I think I told you last time you were on that I have that book. It is completely, almost falling apart because I have read that book and I know exactly the places where I have taken it and I've read it. And I remember when I read it one time where we were staying in Daytona Beach, and it was one of those stormy type of weeks where there was a hurricane coming up in the ocean and everything was sort of wild. And I was reading that then. And I that book just made such an impression on me. I still think of it all the time.
You do know how to make a writer happy.
Well, you know, there are some books that just do that. And the Normandy Triangle has always been just, it's one of my go-to books. I have a few Helen McGinnis books that I love to read. Because people have forgotten about her, and that's a shame because her books are also those kind that you can go back to.
You pick one up and you suddenly say, why is she forgotten?
Exactly, because really I learned all about Europe from her. Those books are so wonderfully written that when I, you know, got old enough and I could start traveling on my own to Europe, I carried her books with me. You know, and
your guide, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, in this case, now, of course, most of us don't know the world of Rampage. We don't know this the life of these people in the mafia, the families, the all of this. And just for the listeners who have not read it, tell us a little bit about it. And because it is a story of revenge. It's a story of families. It's a big story.
Well, I'll tell you a tiny bit about that, and then I'll tell you how I got lucky in my research. Two young brothers working on the summertime at their father's construction site in Manhattan see him murdered by the mob and run over by a truck. And one of them becomes a prosecutor. A assistant United States attorney with the organized crime strike force. The other, Christopher Taggart, he changes his name from their Italian name to his mother's Irish name, Taggart. He comes up with a larger scheme to take revenge. Rather than throwing people in jail, he's going to destroy them completely. And so he is in that world of building skyscrapers. He takes over his father's company. He makes something huge of it. But at the same time, what he's really doing is fighting, creating this almost a second mafia to destroy the first. And where I got lucky in my research, I just happened to know a girl who worked for a publishing house, and out of circumstance and all, suddenly began to realize that she was of a mafia family from Brooklyn. And what was so fascinating was her father was thrown into prison, and her brother was young and not particularly bright. And the father decided she was the only one who could run the criminal enterprise while he was in jail. And so she went from, you know, commuting to New York publishing to going back home and running the family. And I thought, wow, here is a girl, so to speak. Here is a young woman, for my novel. So she becomes Taggart's not only love interest, but ultimately main enemy and antagonist.
Well, you know, many people in subsequent years have used your theme. There have been many copies, but nobody has done it quite as well as you.
I'm glad I'm inspiring.
Well, you have. You have. There have been.
Listen, writers can use every break they can get. If I inspired them, great. They probably inspired me too.
It's funny. Whenever I see, and there's been a couple of television series where, the leader of the bad guys, whatever, drug dealers nowadays and the mafia, whatever, and they are, it's a woman, and I think of you, and I say, okay, somebody ripped Justin Scott here. He did it first, because really, I think you were one of the, I'm perhaps the first who really made the woman.
I got lucky in that I had my verisimilitude in this young woman. Actually, I ended up going to her wedding, which was the classic, Burroughs Italian wedding and also classic mafia wedding, because, of course, the wedding palace was owned by her family, et cetera, et cetera. So I got to meet all sorts of types. And for some reason, I ended up being seated at a table full of bodyguards and their girlfriends. And so they were a wonderful bunch of characters.
Well, I think the Pegasus did a great job of bringing this back, because it really opens it back up for a lot of readers who didn't have the pleasure of reading it the first time around. And I think that was a good idea of theirs.
Good. Yeah, they made a beautiful package.
They did.
Really, really handsome job indeed, yeah.
And I'm waiting for them to do the Normandy again, bring that, because, as I said, first of all, my copy's worn out. But
I'll see if I can find one and send you one in the meantime. Yes, I imagine they will. I'm also really hoping they'll bring back Pride of Royals. I don't know if you've ever read that.
Wow, yes.
Yeah. I think that may be the next, once they catch their breath after doing this one.
Well, yeah, we have. Now, we have to talk about all of them, because what I love, and I was so happy when I, went to your webpage, the time before, because you came in here and we were talking about the anthology In Sunlight or In Shadows.
Anthology. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Because Larry, Larry sent me a list, and he said, okay, these are the contributors to the anthology that I think you should interview. And he said, you have to talk to Justin Scott. And I said, yeah, I know Justin Scott's work so well. And so I was so thrilled when Larry sent me your email and I could get in contact with you. And then I went to your webpage. I love the pictures that you have on that webpage. And I want to tell everyone that they must go to your website.
Oh, good. Send them there. Send them there. Yeah, that was fun putting that together. Larry, we're talking about Larry Block.
Oh, yeah. I love him.
I think I've told you. Stop me if I have. But one of the reasons I became a writer was Larry Block said to me one day, he said, you should be a writer. And I I kind of wanted to be, but I said, why do you say that? And Larry thought for a while. He got silent. He pondered. He kind of stroked his little beard he had then. And he said, well, you look like a writer. So I went home, quit my job, and started writing.
And scared him to death, he told me. Because he said to me, well, you know, what would have happened to this poor kid if I, you know, told him he should be a writer, and then he couldn't write. So he would have felt responsible for the rest of his life.
Well, he's a generous soul. He would have taken me out to dinner on occasion.
I think so. But of course, I think he knew that already. You came from a family of writers, and there should be some writing ability in there somewhere.
A little DNA down in there somewhere that would be dredged up.
Exactly, because your father...
You know, seriously, that did make it easier coming from a family of writers, because I didn't... All writers had a point where they had to go home and tell their parents they're going to be a writer, at which point the parents start tearing their hair out and shrieking, you'll die in poverty, etc. And with my parents, of course, that was the most obvious logical thing to do. And I remember saying to my father, I decided to be a writer, and he looked up from his typewriter. He didn't stop typing. He just slowed down for a moment. He said, good. And then he went back and started typing again.
Oh, that's nice to have that kind of encouragement, and that they didn't throw at you brochures from law schools.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, going back to your webpage, which I want people to go to, because I was so thrilled, you know, with my love for this Normandy Triangle, which I think is such a thrilling read. And you have a picture there. So you did some research for that book.
Indeed. By great good luck, the old France, which had been laid up, she was essentially the successor to the Normandy, the great French liner. And she was the new one. And the France was one of the greats, and then suddenly was laid up. And the Norwegians pulled her out of mothballs, rebuilt her as a cruise ship, and basically painted her, you know, and she sent her on a voyage across the Atlantic. And so I was able to join her and have that sense of being on a pre-World War II liner at the height of its time. The ship was all spanking deliciously, painted new, and it was still at the time where they had, you know, great dining room and people dressed for dinner every night. And so I got to have that experience for writing the Normandy. That was a really lucky break.
Well, with the Normandy, I just, you know, other people just, you know, obsess about the Titanic, but the Normandy was so,
yeah,
so special.
Well, yes, and then to lose her the way she was lost, right there at her own pier in Manhattan, the city that loved her. She was, you know, definitely New York's favorite ship. And there she was, you know, just laying there as the war started and all of a sudden on fire. And I remember when I published the book, so many people would come up to me and say, my parents took me to see her laying on her side in the river, because she lay in the river for, you know, almost 2 years before they were able to write her. And it became this iconic picture in the mind of everyone who was living in town at that time. They would slow down on the West Side Highway and look down at this, you know, poor behemoth on its side.
Well, and of course, the story that you weave in that book, you know, the characters are so compelling. Stephen Gates and of course, the bad guy, Otter. we just love to hate this guy. I think it's one of the best ways that somebody has written a really bad guy. I mean, the search for him is so good. And then, of course, Cordelia, I have always liked. So, you know, that's just a book.
She's a radio lady like you.
That's exactly. I'm thinking, oh, wow, you know. Yeah. So it's just that book draws me. But, you know, what you were mentioning here, and let's talk a little bit about the wonderful, wonderful Russian research that you did and the books that you sort of based in Russia.
Oh, my Lord! On the pride of royals, published in England as Pride of Kings. That was a family story, actually. My sister's husband, my brother-in-law, C.L. Skelton, the English novelist, Scottish novelist. His father was a friend and confidant of King George V, and during the war, as the Russian situation deteriorated, George was trying to get his cousin, Tsar Nicholas, out safely. So he dispatched a officer, and it happened to be my brother-in-law's father, with an offer for the Tsar saying, essentially, I have a destroyer waiting, grab your family and let's go while we can. And the Tsar actually turned him down. He said, no, things were fine, he would stay here, and he made my brother-in-law's father count of the Russian Empire second class, never quite sure why it was second class, and sent him on his way. And what fascinated me was that when you look a little further into the period, the enemy, the German Kaiser, Wilhelm, was also their cousin. So you got these three cousins, and that kind of gave me a bigger story. So I was able to turn it into a pretty huge World War I novel, and which is a fascinating period. And, you know, again, it's weird. But something else I had written some years ago, and all of a sudden, obviously, World War I is really big back here with its 100th anniversary. But I thought, no, I think I've done my World War I. So.
Well, you know, we're back to Russia again. Russia.
Oh, are we indeed?
So I think it's a great time to read this book because it really does, as you say, the three cousins, so the interrelationship of all of these countries, and again, this is a book that does not lose anything through time. If anything, I think there's a bit more depth because now we know what was going on in these countries. And and of course, you made the trip, what, in the 1980s you went?
Yeah, I was over there in Brezhnev's Russia. I was able to get a visa that allowed me to travel alone, which was very unusual back then because things were really locked up tight. And so I thought, okay, if I'm writing this novel set in the winter, I'm going to be there in the winter, which was interesting, shall we say, to say the least. but I was able to see Russia in all of its beauty and glory that it is in the wintertime. And, of course, in those St. Petersburg had become Petrograd in the period of the novel, and then, of course, I'm blanking on what it became in Leningrad in our time. So I was in Leningrad, and it was the same city, the interior city, which was huge, was the same city it had been in during the war, been in 60 years, 70 years earlier. The same tram lines, the same buildings, everything looked as it had then. And what a chance for a novelist to do research of an historical. We can actually be there with people living in the city similarly to the way they lived back then.
Well, you're a method writer, you know. We have method actors. You're a method. You have to go in the you have to go in the wintertime. I mean not, right. A lot of people
well,
would
mean you have to.
How else will you understand it? That's right. Okay, well, lucky you didn't land up in Siberia.
I was very lucky, indeed. there were always people lurking, ready to, you know, kind of, you know, taxi drivers saying, can I take you anyplace, you know. I got around, you know, mostly on foot. Beautiful city, utterly beautiful city. But I'll tell you, Patsy, though, when I arrived, I came in through Moscow, and I arrived just in time for the first snow. And I was literally standing outside the walls of the Kremlin, and with their covered, this beautiful pattern of the snow on the brick. And I'm looking at that brick and I'm thinking, this wall was standing when Columbus discovered America. You know, that's how old they are over there. And it kind of gave me a wonderful sense of who I was going to be writing about in the novel.
Well, you capture the time and you capture the people so well in that novel. And I'm sure that actually now I know that Rampage is going to be a success as a you know, new release, and I have a feeling we're going to have a few more new editions of anniversary editions.
I am very happy to hear that. Pegasus is I think Pegasus will back us there.
Yeah.
It'll be fun. I can send you one of them in a while.
Oh, absolutely.
But for the meantime,
but the next no, if you haven't, if they release, well, either one, then I have to come up to the party because the one for Russia should be really good. We'll have vodka.
Yes.
We'll have we'll really celebrate that.
We will give you plenty of heads up so you can make your travel plans.
Absolutely, I will because, well, you know, I think it's so wonderful. I love your enthusiasm. And as you said, of course, you come from a family of writers, so words and writing is not a daunting task for you. You know, it's there within you. You're a wordsmith, and I'm sure that, you know, you enjoy the research part as much as the writing part.
Yes, I do. Yes, enormously.
And I think that's so nice that you put these pictures. You know, everybody has all these pictures in their album, and they say, what am I going to do with all these pictures? And then you have here the pictures of your travels, and I think that's wonderful. I really like that. It adds depth. And I think one of the things that I've discovered that my listeners really start to relate to writers and sort of invest themselves in the writer. If they are interested, if they find the writer interesting, you know, then they'll go and read more of that writer's books. And so that's why I encourage my listeners to go to the websites if they're good. And in your case, you have an excellent website. And I think it's wonderful that you share these photos with people.
Good. Well, I hope they love them.
And you can look at them and say, oh, I was that young. Well, I'm still as handsome as I was then, right? Yes, you are. Yes, you are. I can see it. You're still as gorgeous. See, Larry Block was right. He said, you look like a writer, you have to be a writer. And he was right.
I'm going to remember this the next time I'm looking at an empty page.
Well, you know, I think you're delightful. And I love your enthusiasm. Of course, I suppose I can't let you go without mentioning that you also, you know, work with Clive Cussler, because I have so many listeners, you know, and Clive, of course, has been on the program, and he's such another delightful writer. You know, I love when a writer is enthusiastic and continues to be enthusiastic. I had Mary Higgins Clark on, and, you know, Mary Higgins, I think it was her third visit on my program, and she's now like 89 years old. But she's...
And going wonderfully strong.
Exactly. You know, and her last book was as good, if not better. I think her last book is perhaps one of the best books she's ever written.
Oh,
and
how wonderful.
Because she has this enthusiasm. And that's what's so important. And that's what comes through, I think, in all of, you know, all of you guys who and gals who have this long-term career. You have to do it because you maintain this enthusiasm, which comes to the reader. So... you know.
Yeah, Mary is the premier example of that. She will start to tell you about what she's working on, and those people are as real to her as if they lived across the back fence. It's just they're hers, you know. Yeah. No, she's a good example for all of us. Yeah.
Exactly, and of course Larry is no slouch as an example.
Oh, good God!
This,
you know, I see Larry a lot. We've been friends forever, but there are two things Larry will say. I'll see him, and he'll say, I've decided I'm not going to write any more books. And then I'll run into him a short while later. I say, how are you doing? He said, well, I just finished a new book. He'll go away, hole up in a cabin somewhere, write an entire novel.
And, of course, Clive Cussler. And the books that you write with him are really great. Again, you manage to get a relationship that really works well.
Yes, that has been great fun. I mean, the Isaac Bell character is an absolute ball to write. And, of course, it's an historical, and I do like historicals, you know, the early 20th century. But, you know, The Cutthroat is out at the moment, and, you know, that was so much fun to write. You know, what we have is a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Jack the Ripper story all tied up in one.
Well, I just am so thrilled always to talk to you and to talk to Larry and to all the guys and all of the people who participated also in you know, in the anthology, because I think it's a great anthology, and I've been really telling people about it. Oh, I know. I have to ask you one question. This is awful to do to you, because I'm doing my summer reading list. I'm asking all my guests to recommend one book. Now, I know that's difficult for you because not your own book, of course. I mean, I will recommend your books, but one book that everybody should read this summer.
Okay, I'm going to give you two.
Okay.
There's a new one out, and it is one of the best thrillers I've ever read. I gave a quote for it. It just came out. It's called A Single Spy.
Okay.
And it's A Single Spy, and it's written by a fellow named William Christie, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-E. And it is about the finest thriller of World War II and Russia and Germany that you will ever read. William Christie, it's from, Minotaur, which is part of St. Martin's. I highly recommend that. The other one I recommend is Michael Chabon's book, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is the towering piece of imagination. The best.
Okay, well, I know that one, and I didn't know A Single Spy, but
yeah,
I will.
It literally just came out, I think, last week.
Ah, okay. I didn't get him yet. I will. As a matter of fact, I'm going to invite him onto the program now.
I think you should, because what this guy has pulled off is truly amazing.
Well, that's
no,
good.
You're in for a treat.
Okay,
really,
I'm going to have him on the program. So I just want to thank you so much, Justin, for being on. And everybody can go to your webpage. It's Justin Scott. And what happens when people type in Justin Scott, they land up with?
They land up with Justin Scott and Paul Garrison.
And Paul Garrison, because that is one of
my other me.
That's right. And you've had a few other yous too, but
I've had a few.
But it will come up. Just Justin Scott is easiest to remember, and everyone, you'll have an absolute treat in reading the 30th edition of Rampage. It's a 30th anniversary edition. It's wonderful. And then go to the webpage and just look at the photos and just have, it's just fun. I love looking at old photos.
Oh, great.
Okay, so.
Lovely. Patsy, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, well, and I'll have you back soon. I'm going to have you back for the next anniversary edition of something, or the new.
Indeed,
newest.
You will.
Okay. Okay, bye, thanks.
Thanks, Patsy. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. We're going to have a little commercial, and then we'll be right back. I've got a great guest coming up.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
I stayed up all night reading this book. We can say that on your behalf to media and tastemakers, but it would be silly for you to brag on your own book. When you need a champion in your corner promoting your work, JKS Communications is with you every step of the way. We take care of the details of promoting you and your book so that you can spend your time and energy focusing on what you do best. Radio and TV interviews, newspaper features, book tours, social media, video. You can do it all, and we're here to make it happen. In 12 years, we've helped more than 700 authors and 1,200 books find their fan base. Everyone at JKS Communications loves what we do, and it shows in our enthusiasm. We're going to make a great team with you. Check us out at jkscommunications.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of My Pillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented My Pillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. My Pillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry My Pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose.
Mike is offering 50% off his 4-pack special.
Go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-871-1543 and use the promo code PATSY, and Mike will offer you free shipping. Once again, that's 800-871-1543, promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I am back with a very special guest, Heather McLean. Hi, Heather, are you there?
I am. I'm right here.
Okay, well, I want to do a special introduction for you.
Okay.
Okay. From the author of Baby Gizmo, From Pacifiers to Potties, comes a brilliant new novel. Hi. I love it. I love it. You are so good. You are such a great writer. And I was like, wow. What's going on with you? You are amazing. We went from when you were writing about pacifiers and potties, and then suddenly one day I wake up and I find out that you're on my list here for a wonderful, wonderful new novel. How are you doing?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's so exciting. The title of the book is called Toward a Secret Sky, and I love the cover they did for you. They did a beautiful cover. And
I love it.
And, I took one look at it. I said, whoa, this is a special book. And then when I discovered that you were, well, of course, the books that you wrote before, nonfiction, obviously, and then you came out with this book, and it's amazing.
Well, thank you. I
really should tell people that, I always read, of course, the dedication in a book. And so I was really moved by the dedication in this book, because most people would put for so-and-so and so-and-so. But you have done a beautiful dedication, and I want to read it to people because it is really touching. To my childhood heroes, librarians, docents of the public domain who regularly rescued me from my own small world and sent me on countless adventures. Wow, that's nice.
Well, it's true. I grew up in the middle of the woods in Missouri, and I came from a broken home, and we did not have books were everything to me, and Bookmobile Day was the highlight of my life. We also had a small used bookstore in town that I would ride my bike into, and I had a credit with them I would trade books in. And our public library, it was just my happy place as a kid. They just knew everything, and they knew how to point me to the books I would love, different from the books my sister might love. And they were right every time. It's just my childhood was saved by books.
Well, I know the feeling. I was born in Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
And fabulous.
Also in the middle of nowhere. And we didn't have books. And I started to read really comic books were my first books. And at one point, we moved down to Detroit, down to the city. And still, one of the most magical days of my life was the day that we had moved to the city. I was in second grade at the time. And my older sister, took me to McGregor Public Library. And I still remember that the walk up to the door, and it was one of those big old libraries that they built in the 30s, those big solid buildings. And we walked in that place, and it was so magical. And I realized that all of those books I could read someday, and they were mine. It was like and so that's why when I read this dedication to librarians, I thought that is so sweet, because I know you have, the book was inspired by your daughters. And I hope they don't mind, but I think it was wonderful that you put this dedication in there for librarians.
Yes. I meet librarians all the time. I think it's such a wonderful job that they do. And I think it's so underappreciated, especially with the internet now. People think that they can sort themselves out, but librarians offer so much more than just book recommendations. They're so integral to the community. So I want to give them a little praise.
Well, you did. And Toward a Secret Sky, of course, it's a mix of reality and fantasy. And we'll talk a little bit about it's, the first chapter is is so strong. And I'm thinking to myself, whoa, this is one great writer here.
Thank you so much. I wanted the book to be what I call reality mixed with possibility. It's not pure science fiction. It's not pure fantasy, but it's like the adult books I love to read the most, like Dan Brown, and, you know, I grew up with the Indiana Jones movies. The idea that the world as it is holding so many ancient secrets. And if you really look for them and you are on the path to uncover them, suddenly the world you've known your whole life becomes this magical place without magic.
And we see it through the eyes of a 17-year-old girl whose name is Maren Hamilton, who has become an orphan. And there's a reason for it. And that's revealed in the book. But what I love about her is she is just an every girl. She is just an ordinary girl who's thrust into a different world.
Yes, that was a huge point for me in writing the book. I wanted her to be, I didn't even describe her very well. I didn't want her to have the most stunning green eyes or to be certain height. I wanted every single reader to be able to relate to her in that she is a normal girl in not normal circumstances. But I think that it was important to me because that's me. I don't have superpowers. I've been in extraordinary situations before, and you don't have, you know, I didn't have superpowers to rely on. You have to rely on what you were given, which is just your normal brain.
And then talk about going into new worlds. For an American girl to land up in Scotland can be a bit of a shock.
Yes.
Oh, yes. And you do it so well, because I love how you, I always love books where they talk about food. And my favorite book of the moment is called A Gentleman in Moscow, which I love. And in that book, he talks a lot about food. So I'm like eating everything that he has in this book. I never liked honey, but because he describes honey so beautifully, I'm buying honey now, and I'm not really eating much of it, but I taste it and I smell it and I think, oh, I'm back in Moscow.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So but in your case, I'm not going to eat. Listen, I've been to Scotland and I know I'm not gonna eat some of that stuff.
Yes. It's fascinating. It's the most beautiful country, and the people are fantastic. The food is just not my cup of tea.
And, to put it mildly, and your husband's from Scotland, so.
Yes, and he loves it, and we've exposed our kids to it as well. But, and, you know, there are certainly some fabulous dishes.
Yeah, but they're not into black pudding, are they?
You know, my children are not into black pudding, but they love clotted cream. It's funny because my husband will give you the opposite perspective, because he's not from America. He did not grow up here. He finds the most ridiculous American foods that we take for granted that we love, and he will not go near them. Like, he was just telling my kids yesterday, he will never in his entire life eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You can't pay him $1 million. There's nothing more disgusting. And my kids are like, what? Peanut butter. They don't eat peanut butter in Scotland.
Oh, I know.
They don't eat peanuts to make a butter. He thinks it's the grossest. They don't eat, you know, the things we love so much, cornbread. My mother-in-law was over for Thanksgiving one year, and she was revolted. She kept asking me, why would you put corn in a bread?
Well, I think that
they feel the same way.
That's what makes this book so enjoyable, that you really do create this world. Maren lands up there with her grandparents, and then in a way this is sort of like a Da Vinci Code, because there are a lot of mystery, there's a lot of riddles to untangle, and that's why I think this book really works so well.
I really loved, I felt like there were so many great adventure books when you are in middle school. And then when you're an adult, there are so many great adventure thriller type books. And I really felt I have three children and two of them are teenagers. And so they read everything under the sun. And they were complaining to me that most of the books for YA, you know, they go from Harry Potter and Percy Jackson to very serious topics about police brutality and bulimia and my mother's an alcoholic and, or pure fantasy with girls and swords and fantasy worlds. And they really missed the adventure. They really missed the idea that the world could come alive in these ways. So that's why I wanted to write the book for teens. It's not a middle school book. It's definitely for teens, but it has all of that Da Vinci Code goodness of all of the places in the book are real. You can trace their you can trace the character's footsteps, and you can go underneath the cathedral in London, St. Paul's Cathedral, into the crypt, and go right to the tomb, and that is the exact plaque on the wall. You can. I'm not going to promise that anything crazy will happen if you solve a clue, but every location in the book, the secret city under London, the inside of Big Ben, all of it is true.
Well, of course, I know you've done the research, and I highly recommend to everyone that they take a trip to Scotland. It is wonderful. It is beautiful. I will never forget the first time that I went to Scotland, and my husband and I are driving around. We rented a little car, and we're driving these twisty little turny roads all over Scotland, and I had wanted to go to the home of John Paul Jones, who, of course, you know, was born in Scotland. And I had the name there, and it's very clear. It's in a place called Kirkcudbright. And so we kept, you know, every place we were driving, we'd see somebody walking along, you know, the side of the road. We'd see all these very quaint-looking people, and we'd say, you know, could you – tell us which way is Kirkcudbright. This is before, you know, GPS got to Scotland. And they'd say, they'd say something more or less, but we didn't quite understand. But by the hand indication, we assumed we had to turn left and then turn right. And so we turned left and turned right, and we kept going. And then we'd find somebody else, and they'd say, you know, with their, we couldn't understand them. The progress. So, but then we turn right and turn left and turn left. And we did this for like an hour and a half. Before finally we got to a little village, and we actually got out of the car and walked in the store and said, I know this place is somewhere nearby, and I'm showing, you know, that it's Kirkcudbright. And the guy looks at me and he says, I can't understand everything, but it comes out Kukubri. And I said, that doesn't look at all like Kirkcudbright. Kirkcudbright, Kukubri, yes. So it's a fun place to get lost in Scotland.
That's very true. It is. And it's very easy to get lost in Scotland.
Oh, it is. I know. And now, of course, with your husband traveling along, does he still have this lovely accent?
He does. I unfortunately don't hear it as much as I used to. Our first date, I didn't understand a word he said, and I did not care. I just nodded at him and was like, this is fantastic.
Yeah, because I think he's like your, I think you've one of your characters is something like him, handsome, gorgeous prince, kind of.
he is to me, yes. He's he's just such a treasure. We've been married for 23 years now, and we met and eloped 3 months after meeting.
Oh, that's
so
sweet.
Yes, it's been a whirlwind, but I truly believe it, love at first sight. When I met him, I was with some friends on spring break, and one of my friends, we met at Disney World. He was on the International Exchange Program, and he worked at the Rose and Crown Pub, and my friends and I were on spring break at Disney World and for college, and one of my friends went up to get a beer and came back and said, I just found your husband. And I was like, stop it, you're being ridiculous. And they said, no, go up to the bar and order something. And they said, no, I have a beer. You just brought me one. They go, no, go order a beer. And I went up and the crowds parted and there he was. And it was love at first sight. And so I always chuckle when people say, oh, there's so much, you know, the idea of love at first sight, attraction at first sight in your book. It's so out there. I promise you it's not.
No,
it exists.
I can tell you.
It's the most hopeful thing in the world. It can happen to you in five minutes from now.
It happened to me almost exactly the same way. My husband, I was in my office. My husband walked, and he was going to walk into my office, but he stopped right at the doorway, and there was one of these, you know, fluorescent lights above the doorway. And his hair, because it had been raining outside, his hair was wet, and it was like, it just sparkled. It was like I took one look at him, and right then, I mean, I knew I was going to marry this man. Exactly. I mean, it's amazing. And when people, I've told people this, and I said that was it. It was just he stood there, and you know, if he'd have just walked in, you know, like I don't know if I would have had this, but he just, because he stood there under the light for a moment, it was like magic, and I just I fell in love with him. That was it.
Yes, exactly.
Isn't it wasn't? It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yes. Fabulous. How long have you been married?
More than 30 years.
Oh,
yeah,
fabulous.
We're getting there. We're getting there. But it's fantastic. It's a wonderful feeling. And I think that's, you know, you have captured in this book some magic. And that's important. I think it makes the story come alive. And it makes, I think, a great read for, as you said, for young people to have this kind of a story and the kind of hope. We're not going to give the story away because I really think people should read this first chapter. Once they read this, well, actually the first two paragraphs, you're hooked on this book. You know, it's
good.
You've done a great job. And I, you know, can't let you go without saying, of course, I don't know exactly how you got from pacifiers to potties and you did a lot of nonfiction books, and I, you know, and then you just came out with this. I mean, it's like, whoa.
Well, I had done 13 nonfiction books, and I love writing nonfiction. I loved being in school. I love writing, and for me, nonfiction comes really easily. It's like writing a school paper, which I loved. But as my children have grown up and, you know, there's just this idea that you want to read something that they can read and love. So my last nonfiction book was about, it was a neuroscience book about the FBI. And my children just were not, it was the most exciting book, but my children could care less. So I thought, I would love to share. I love reading the same books as my children, and I would love to share that experience with them. And so I decided, why not try a fiction book for young adults? I certainly have read enough, because I do like to read what my kids are reading. So I figured if I could come up with something that hadn't been done that was unique, I would give it a try. So I did, and it was much more difficult to write than nonfiction.
Well, how long did it take you?
I would say 2 full years, whereas the nonfiction generally takes about 60 to 90 days. So it was quite different.
Well, whatever you did in those 2 years, you did some magic, you know,
thank you.
And that just comes through in the writing. And I hope that, you know, I hope that a lot of young people will read this, and I think that they will be inspired. And one of the things I love also, I had to mention, I love books where there's depth to it, where like you weave in the history, you know, it's just woven in there. It's part of the story. And I love the way you did that.
Oh, thank you. For me, a book is an investment. My favorite book genre is historical fiction because I love having learned. I mean, I love to read nonfiction, but for fiction as well, I love to have walked away from the book with some kind of knowledge of how life used to be, even the little details, how they cooked, what food they ate. I love that. And so for my book, I wanted it to be unlike pure fantasy. Fantasy is a fabulous escape, but I feel like you've invested all of this time into the book, and at the end of it, what do you have? You don't have a lot to talk with other people about. Oh, did you read the fantasy book about the sword and the planet of Asgardia? And it's all made up by the author. You have memorized fake words that the author made up. I wanted instead for kids to get that confidence that comes from knowledge that they, without having left their home state, learned about archaeology, modern architecture, art, history, culinary things. I talk about the berries that they used in Scotland to make jam in World War II. They thought gave the pilots night vision, and mummification, and even neuroscience things, neurogenetic gifts feature in the book. But I wanted kids to feel empowered by all of that learning, but not that they were reading a textbook, they were reading a fun adventure.
Exactly.
But along the way, they were learning stuff they could, you know, sort of brag to their friends. I love that when you can turn to your parent and go, did you know that they used the jam for night vision in World War II or whatever it is?
Okay, well, Heather, I want to thank you so much for being on today. And
thank you for having me.
It must be also something special that your name was Heather and you met a guy from Scotland.
My surname was not Scottish at all.
Wow. Well, I want people to read this book. I think they will really enjoy it, and they should also go to your website because there's lots of stuff that they can look up too. And it's Heather McLean, right?
Yes, Heather-McLean.
Oh, Heather dash.
I had to add the dash.
Okay.
Yes.
And I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. And
thank
I'm going
you.
To put you on my recommendations for summer reading. And
fabulous.
And the Scottish Tourist Bureau should send you four round trip tickets to come to Scotland first class, right?
I wish.
Okay. Thanks so much for being on today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Bye now. Wow, I like her. I like there's so much about her. As a matter of fact, she was a Richard Branson choice for Entrepreneur of the Year. There's so much to talk about her. But I don't have time because it's time to go. And I just want to remind you that, it's one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. Or really nowadays, in an audible book. So get some time set aside and start writing. And meanwhile, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it and say something nice to somebody today. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And just have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Bye for now.